Hi, Boston. How are you doing today? How is everyone's day so far? Good? Amazing. Woo! Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. My name is Christine Mastrangelo. I'm on the board of the Boston Book Festival. We are celebrating our 15th year, so happy to be here. And we just thank you for all of your support for coming out. We are a nonprofit. We do see this as a beautiful gift that we package up to the city and for all of the lovers of reading and books. So if you do feel like you can contribute any sort of amount, $5, $25, whatever it might be, please consider doing that. So welcome to readings by debut novelists. These are all super talented authors. I'm so excited to introduce you to them. The way that the programming will work today is that each author will have time to do a reading from their novel, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. And there will also be a book signing right outside the main entrance here of the cafe. So please chat with the authors here and support them and buy their books. Thank you so much. So first, to my left, I have James Frankie Thomas. He will be reading from his debut novel, Idlewild. In addition to being a novelist, critic, and teacher, James is a lifelong New Yorker. He graduated from City College of New York and the Iowa's Writing Workshop. His writing has appeared in the Paris Review, Lit Hub, and Vulture. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
And in the middle is Rebecca Bergman. She'll be reading from her debut novel, The Museum of Human History. Her writing has appeared in Lit Hub, Poets and Writers, and several other numerous literary journals. The Museum of Human History was named one of Wired magazine's best books of the summer, having received star reviews from Kirkus and Booklist. And she's also a contributing editor of Noon and lives in Rhode Island with her family. Welcome. And finally, we'll hear from Christy Cashman. She'll be reading from her debut novel, The Truth About Horses. And Christy is a film producer and actress who has appeared in American Hustle, Joy, The Descendants, Ted 2, and many other films that we all love and enjoy. And she is also the founder of Youth Inc., which is a mentorship program for kids to explore storytelling and the arts, and is a big supporter of the Boston Public Library as she serves as the co-chair of Literary Lights. So thank you so much for spending time with us today. So James, we'll have you kick it off.
All right, I am so happy to start. Is my mic on? My mic is on, right? Very happy to be number one, the first one. So my novel, Idlewild, is a novel for adults, though it is, that's louder, that's better, right? Sorry. A novel for adults about teenagers. Specifically, it is about two teenagers who are best friends at a Quaker high school in the year after 9/11 in New York City. And the two best friends are named Faye and Nell, and they both narrate in alternating POV. And the section that I am going to read to you is from the first chapter that is narrated by Nell as she recounts the circumstances under which she first met the person who would become her best friend, Faye. Can everyone hear me? Is my mic on properly? Okay. This is the last time I will ask, I promise. I can be loud. Idlewild is the name of their school, by the way. I think that's all the context you need. For my first 2 years at Idlewild, I had no friends. I didn't mind it much. I appreciated that no one paid attention to me, that I could move through the school unnoticed. It meant that I could have a whole secret routine. Every morning, I showed up 10 minutes early so I could lurk outside the East 15th Street entrance to the meeting house and wait for Faye Vasquez Rabinowitz to show up. Once she appeared, I'd follow her from a safe distance into the meeting house and hover creepily in the aisle, waiting for her to choose a bench so I could choose my own seat accordingly. I didn't want to sit next to her. I wanted to sit behind her at a slight angle so I could spend all of meeting looking at her in profile, studying the outline of her boobs. As a crush object, Faye was kind of an odd choice. I was convinced I was the only one in the whole school who recognized her beauty, although I'm sure that was just a self-flattering fantasy. There must have been plenty of boys ogling her too, not even just her chest. She had a striking face with dramatic dark eyebrows, I wouldn't have been attracted to her if she hadn't been attractive. Still, she seemed to go out of her way to downplay her looks. Her thick, dark hair was chopped short, and sometimes it looked like she hadn't brushed it or even washed it in a while. Her clothes were so baggy that, at the time, I didn't yet know the full extent of her Jessica Rabbit proportions. There was no hiding those boobs, but she didn't wear a bra, so they were always flopping around. Arousing, but also a little grotesque. Even if you'd given her the full Breakfast Club makeover, she wouldn't have been anything close to the most beautiful girl in our class. Lily Day Jones had the claim to that title. Despite that, Lily Day Jones never captured my imagination like Faye. Lily's beauty was a public asset, like Central Park, made for red-blooded boys and Shakespeare festivals and modeling scouts from Teen People magazine. Beautiful girls belong to the world, but Faye, scruffy, slouching, fast-talking Faye, Faye belonged to me. I'd had my suspicions about Faye since day one. Part of it was the outfit she wore to freshman orientation. Green army jacket, combat boots, cargo pants. For context, though, lots of girls were wearing cargo pants in the fall of 1999. Plus, I had similar suspicions about every girl I found attractive, including Laura Prepon on That 70s Show, Laura Prepon in real life, and Daria Morgendorfer, a literal cartoon character on MTV. It was all wishful thinking. I had no idea what signs to look for, so every girl on Earth was Schrodinger's lesbian. Soon, though, Faye gave me more to work with. We had freshman English together, and during class discussion, she was always bringing up gay shit. Like, always. We read the Iliad, and she wouldn't shut up about how Achilles and Patroclus were boyfriends. We read The Great Gatsby, and she physically thrashed and squealed in front of everybody when we got to that weird party scene where Nick Carraway ends up in bed with some dude in his underwear. We read the freaking Bible, and I resigned myself to a dry spell for gay shit, but I hadn't counted on David and Jonathan in the Book of Samuel. "Ms. Caputo," she cried out, raising her hand with such force that her boobs flopped around and her armpit hair peeked out of her t-shirt sleeve. Whenever she raised her hand like that, all the other kids in class snickered and rolled their eyes like, there she goes with the gay shit conspiracy theories again. Even with Gatsby, where the gay shit was textual. "Oh yay," she said, stabbing her fingertip against the passage she'd highlighted in her Oxford study Bible. "There is so much oh yay between David and Jonathan." Well, I knew from my gay corner of the internet that ho-yay stood for homoeroticism. Yay! If Faye knew this too, then she must have been visiting the same gay corner of the internet, which meant... On the other hand, she never had anything to say regarding les-yay, not even when it came to Ruth and Naomi, the Bible's most obvious dykes to watch out for. Faye's interest in gay shit appeared completely limited to guy-on-guy. So the jury was still out. Maybe she was just twice as heterosexual as most girls. At least, that's what I tried to tell myself. The truth was, from the moment I first heard her say the word gay... Whoops. Oh, no. Sorry, can you help me with this? There's so much more here. Thank you. How's that?
Let's see. If you can maybe just hold
it. Okay, thank you. I'll just hold it on.
Perfect.
The truth was, from the moment I first heard her say the word gay in class, I would have thrown myself in front of the M23 crosstown bus for Faye Vasquez Rabinowitz. Day after day, I sat in the desk next to hers and studied her handwriting and crossed my Z's the way she did. Night after night, I typed Faye Vasquez Rabinowitz into the Yahoo search bar, finding nothing, of course, about this random 14-year-old girl in the year 1999. One day, I overheard an art teacher mention that Faye's dad was a Mexican artist who was kind of famous, in the art world anyway, so I switched to searching his name over and over until I became a sort of accidental expert on him. Ask me anything about his multimedia installation in the 1983 Whitney Biennial. From his 1984 New York Times wedding announcement, I learned that Faye's mom was a garment business heiress who did charity stuff. From black and white society party photos in the Sunday Styles section, I learned that she was dark-haired and busty, like her daughter. I created a LiveJournal blog just to keep track of all this research. Its privacy setting was friends locked, meaning no one could read it unless they were on my list of approved LiveJournal friends. Since I had no friends on LiveJournal or anywhere else, the blog was essentially unfindable, which freed me to go fully nuts on it. Every day, I went home and blogged about Faye, where she lived, according to the school directory, 23rd Street, just like me, but we were on opposite ends, what she'd worn to school that day, the green army jacket, always over a t-shirt, what her Starbucks order was, tall caramel frappuccino, what books she surreptitiously read under her desk, Sherlock Holmes, Dorian Gray, Rimbaud poetry, who she hung out with after school. No one, apparently. Did I ever talk to her? Ha. Back then, I was too shy to talk to anyone at school unless they talked to me first, which Faye never did. At home, though, I talked about Faye nonstop. I never officially came out to my mom, but my crush was so humiliatingly obvious that my mom grew concerned. One day, I came home crying like a little bitch because I'd caught Faye looking at me with a facial expression that I interpreted as pure contempt for me, and also I was on my period and my entire body felt like one giant sob. She hates me, I wailed. Why does she hate me? My mom, who is herself a therapist, which was why I'd been in therapy since second grade, said, you should bring this up in therapy. So I did. In my next session with Dr. Rothstein, I described a recent non-interaction with Faye and asked, what do you think it means? Dr. Rothstein, a middle-aged lady with the longest hair I'd ever seen on a middle-aged lady, replied placidly, what do you think it means? I think, I said, I'm a lesbian. Although I'd known this about myself since middle school, that was the first time I'd said it aloud, and it felt so unexpectedly intense that as soon as the words were out of my mouth, I burst into tears. Dr. Rothstein frowned, no longer placid. You're only 14, she said. You don't need to label yourself right now. I grabbed a handful of complimentary Kleenex from the table next to me and buried my face in it. I'm pretty sure, I said in a small voice that got swallowed by the wad of tissues and the white noise machine. You know, she said, it's very common for girls your age to develop crushes on other girls. Trust me, I could hear the quotation marks around crushes. But it doesn't have to mean anything about your sexuality. And I realized she'd misunderstood my tears. She thought I was crying about being a lesbian, that I wanted reassurance that I wasn't a lesbian. In reality, I was fucking psyched about being a lesbian, but I didn't know how to say this to Dr. Rothstein. Don't lock yourself into an identity, okay? She said gently. I nodded and made a mental note not to bring this up with her again. All this angst and ho-yay and bad therapeutic advice continued more or less through sophomore year. Faye did all the plays and musicals, so I did too. That helped with my shyness a little. By the end of sophomore year, I was on friendly terms, if not real friends, with a handful of fellow theater kids. But it didn't bring me any closer to Faye, which was okay with me, honestly. I was fully prepared to graduate without ever having spoken to her. I was happy to adore her from afar. But one morning, at the beginning of junior year, everything changed. I was at my usual post on East 15th Street, leaning against the wrought iron fence, listening to a CD on my Discman, when I spotted Faye standing just a few feet away, not walking or reading or listening to music, just standing on the sidewalk in a patch of sunlight. She caught me looking at her, heart attack, smiled, double heart attack, and spoke, R.I.P. Nell Rifkin, dead of three consecutive heart attacks. I saw her lips move, but didn't hear what she said because of the music blasting through my headphones. I wish I didn't remember this, but it was Blink-182's album, Enema of the State. I pressed pause on my Discman, took off the headphones, placed them around my neck, and spoke my very first word to Faye. What? It's such a beautiful day, she said. I must have said something in reply, probably an expression of agreement. It was a beautiful day. I just want to stay out here forever, she said, preferably in a bikini. I looked very quickly at the ground so she wouldn't notice me having any kind of facial reaction to the idea of her body in a bikini. The universe rewarded me by showing me a shiny quarter on the sidewalk. Childishly, I went, hey, a quarter, and knelt down to pick it up. Faye asked, old or new? The government had recently started to roll out new quarters whose tail side depicted, instead of an eagle, the iconography of a particular state. They were still a collectible novelty at the time. My favorites were Georgia, which had a peach, and South Carolina, which had a little bird. I inspected it. New, I said. The tail side said, live free or die. New Hampshire, I said. And then, impulsively, you can have it. By the time I realized what a weird and desperate gesture that was, it was too late. I was already holding it out to her. Oh, I couldn't possibly, she deadpanned. No, take it, I insisted, feeling like I now had no choice but to commit to the bit. As a token of my, chivalry? Esteem, I said at the same time. No, chivalry, that's better. By then, everyone else had gone into the meeting house. Rather than argue, Faye took the quarter and shoved it into the pocket of her cargo pants. We walked inside. Not together, exactly, but the junior benches were mostly filled up, which meant that Faye and I had no choice but to sit together. She sat down. I sat next to her. My butt touched her butt. I mean, we were basically having sex. Seriously, it was dizzying to be so physically close to her. I could smell her. It wasn't a pleasant or unpleasant smell. It was just recognizably the smell of her body. But compared to the cucumber melon chemicals that wafted off other girls, it was like seeing her naked. I didn't know what to do with myself. I looked at the big clock on the wall. We had almost a full minute before silence fell. Had we exhausted the topic of the weather? I remembered that we were in the same English class again, American Lit. I asked, what do you think of the Scarlet Letter so far? She began to answer, but it was right at that moment that Eddie Applebaum squeezed his way onto the bench beside us. Eddie was always late for meeting, which was just one of his many daily public embarrassments. Another one was that he was fat. Not like unusually so. There were plenty of other fat kids at Idlewild, including me. But it was Eddie Applebaum, whose name was tauntingly invoked in 1,000 games of Fuck, Marry, Kill, and who died 1,000 hypothetical deaths as a result. What's more, he had a naturally high-pitched voice and an emotionally expressive face, both of which made him seem gay, and that was often the subtext of the teasing. But only the subtext. Idlewild kids didn't have a problem with gay people. They just had a problem with Eddie Applebaum. And I was no exception. Sometimes I felt sorry for him, but that morning, when he interrupted my conversation with Faye, I hated his needy round face. I hated his stupid Yankees cap, which he was supposed to take off in the meeting house. I hated his squeaky voice as he leaned in close to us and said, guess what I just saw? I ignored him. Sorry, Faye, I said. What were you saying about the Scarlet Letter? But Eddie Applebaum was persistent. You guys, he said, I just saw a plane crash into the World Trade Center. Faye reached into the pocket of her cargo pants and pulled out the New Hampshire sidewalk quarter. Here, she said, call someone who cares. She flicked it at Eddie's face. He flinched, and as the coin bounced off his nose and onto the gray carpeted floor, Faye glanced at me. It was a really quick glance, the way you'd fake casually glance at your reflection in a storefront window, almost impossible to catch. But I caught it. She was hoping to make me laugh. And I did. I laughed and laughed. Silence was falling, but I couldn't stop. The happiest year and a half of my life started right then. Thank you.
James, thank you so much. I'd like to invite the audience to ask a question if they might be so curious. No? So that was so humorous and authentic, particularly to the teenage voice in terms of what's going on in the mind and how do you control the body at the same time.
Age-old question, right?
Yeah, and it's set up. Oh, thank you so much. And I think you started setting up at the very end in terms of the actual seriousness of how this novel is going to be, revolving around, because they're basically meeting on 9/11. So there's this kind of like very exact moment that they meet and a very exact moment of their lives. And the narrators are actually retelling this 15 years later. So maybe you can just tell us a little bit about how the memory of perspective and how you look back on sort of your own character's coming of age, how did you sort of weave through some of that interspersive time?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. You know, first-person long retrospective is one of my very favorite narrative modes. It's one of my very favorite POVs to write in, but also to read. And a novelist that was really influential on my decision to write in this mode was, I think I started outlining and brainstorming this novel right around the time that Elena Ferrante's Neapolitan novels were just blowing up in popularity. And she was really such a game changer. I mean, I think we're all book people, right? So we all remember, like, the year that everybody was reading My Brilliant Friend and the other three books in the series. And you remember one of the things that made those novels so compelling and such a phenomenon was that Elena Ferrante was a pseudonym, and nobody knew who she really was. She was a mystery. She was her identity was not known to anyone. It was a big, big secret. And I bring this up because what made her, like, who cares who she was? She was some random Italian lady. But everybody wanted to know who she was in real life because her novels were written in this first-person long retrospective that really made them feel like they were telling a true story. Like, it was impossible not to read My Brilliant Friend and believe on some level that you were reading somebody's true story about growing up in Naples, very poor. And then I think just a few years ago, the true identity of Elena Ferrante was discovered. And, you know, spoiler alert, she was just some random Italian lady. And believe it or not, you guys may not know this if you didn't follow this closely, she was not from Naples. She actually was not Neapolitan. Her husband was, I think. But I just thought that was it was just such a testament to the power of the first-person long retrospective form that if you write in this first-person I voice, and not just write in the past tense, but specifically bring your feelings about, like, their character's feelings about the past to the narration, like, it's amazing how effective it is to tell a story and just be constantly filling in the gaps with, I think this is what happened, but I don't remember, or I probably did this, or I feel so embarrassed that I did this now. I can't believe I did that. That's not who I am. It's just incredible how much texture and what a feeling of authenticity it brings to the story. So Elena Ferrante is mother in that sense. I was really thinking about her a lot when I started writing these long retrospective chapters. And I didn't include this in the section I read today, but there are other chapters in this novel that are narrated in the first person present tense by Faye and Nell when they are actually teenagers in the year 2002. And the contrast between that first-person present tense and the first-person long retrospective, it's like flicking a light switch on and off. It's such a dramatic juxtaposition. It's like seeing something so close up that it's unrecognizable to you, and then seeing something from so far away that you can barely see it. I had a ton of fun toggling between those two modes, and that's what fueled me to get to the end of this novel, was just the fun of comparing and contrasting the right up too close to see with the too far away to see. A lot of humor and drama in there too.
Thank you for sharing that, especially the sort of art and craft of your thought. And I especially really felt like there was a lot of urgency in the voice and the narrative, so that definitely lent to the authenticity of it. So Faye and Nell, they definitely become very entangled. And I think what is also very beautiful in the story is there is this kind of reflective self-questioning that they bounce off one another. And it may or may not lead to some revelations. I don't know if we want to give it away, but maybe you can kind of just talk about that character development there and talk about the revelation of, you know, coming of age as well.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's funny, one of the other authors here and I were just talking before this panel started about how it's kind of funny that we're all on the coming of age panel, because maybe none of our books quite actually fit the genre description of coming of age. When my colleague here reads from her novel, you will see why coming of age is kind of an ironic label for hers. But back to mine, coming of age feels like a bit of an ironic label for Idlewild, because what becomes so clear as the novel goes on is that really, both of my characters, but I think particularly Faye, who you did not hear from today, has really not come of age, to put it bluntly. She is so, so stuck in high school. She has not progressed since, like, March 2003. That's where her mind still is. That's all she's thought about since then. So, you know, what does it mean to come of age? Does it mean to hit some sort of psychological milestone? Does it mean to
evolve in your relationality to other people, or does it just mean to physically age, which I think it, in the book, even Faye is not like physically aging very noticeably. But I think that's poignant and interesting too in its way, because regardless of whether we have hit the appropriate milestones for coming of age, age comes for us regardless, one way or the other. So I think I was thinking a lot about that kind of stuckness and arrested development and failure to launch in a like psychological, interpersonal way as I was working on this book. And it is, I think, very easy to, you know, I'm going to address the elephant in the room here. I know what I look like. I think it's very easy to reduce this to the trans lens and saying, oh, that's a dysphoric thing because trans people have not become their true selves yet. I don't think it's just a trans thing. I think a lot of people struggle with this. I think many, many people can recognize the feeling of not having fully grown up or come of age, whatever that means, perhaps especially nowadays. But I do think being trans gives one a lot of insight into this phenomenon, and if you're interested in that, you should definitely check out this book. Someone just held up the time card. Yeah. That's why my tone just changed abruptly.
Thank you so much, James. Appreciate your authenticity there. Absolutely.
Great job.
All right, Rebecca Bergman will read from Museum of Human History.
Can everyone hear me? Great. So I'm going to read from my novel. It's called The Museum of Human History. I like to describe it as a futuristic fairy tale, and it centers around a girl who falls into a coma, and she stops physically aging, which is why Coming of Age is a funny title for the session for me. But it follows a bunch of different characters, and I'm just going to read some excerpts from the introduction to two of those characters, and there's not much you need to know about them because this is the first time the reader and you all will meet them. On their trip to the canyon, Tess started calling herself Dying Tess again, as if terminal illness transformed her into a new person entirely. She told Luke, "You don't like Dying Tess," Dying Tess, as she put her coat on. It was not a question. "I love Dying Tess," he clarified, and he kissed her. But as they found their car in the motel parking lot, he thought more about it. He decided they were both right. When Tess first became sick, there were all these scientific advancements being announced to great fanfare. Three biotech companies had opened branches in the city, and their names were futuristic and easily interchangeable. Genesix, Zeneva, Vextigen. Signs of the end times, Tess would say, whenever technology was getting ahead of itself. She kept a list of ominous headlines. It started with extinct animal, cloned. Biotech researchers had reanimated fossilized DNA from a woolly mammoth. The cloned animal was born in one of the shiny new research facilities downtown, not far from their apartment. On his way to work in the mornings, Luke would bike by the line of reporters, all waiting in the lot of the office park so they might catch one of the scientists and try to get a comment. Their news cameras were lightweight and sleek. They made the medium format that Luke carried in its own pack with all its separate attachments feel like an artifact, which in some ways it was. Nobody used that kind of camera anymore. The woolly mammoth was named Dolly Jr. after the famous cloned sheep, and she was held in a pen where visitors could see her. The big debate wasn't over Dolly herself, but whether to bring back a male and revive the species. They went to see her once. They felt sorry for Dolly, and they wanted to apologize on behalf of all people. This was before Tessa's surgery, but after the surgery date had been scheduled. A strange period when all they could do was wait and pretend their lives weren't just hanging in the balance. "Nobody asks to be born," Tess said, staring at the enormous mammal, "or to be born again." "There is such loneliness in being the last of your kind," Luke said. Already they were talking past each other. They watched the animal for about a half hour. Her eyes were big black marbles, wet and melancholy, as if she might start to weep at any moment, releasing tears so big they would splash back from the ground. "The lonely mammoth," Tess said. Then, turning to Luke, "That's a good title." Visitors weren't supposed to take pictures, but nobody stopped him or said anything when he snapped one of Dolly with Tess at her side. "The lonely mammoth," she wrote down in her notebook, under a list she kept of good titles for his photographs. Aside from their love of antiques, Luke and Tess were opposites in most ways. He worked in advertising, and she worked for a human rights organization. That meant Tess helped create new lives for refugees, and Luke helped create maybe the one thing that could always leave people a little less fulfilled: longing. They used to joke about it. A marriage of late-stage capitalism, they said. They couldn't afford to both work to make the world a better place, right? One of them had to pay the bills and make the world slightly worse. It might balance out their karma. At the diner near the canyon, Luke ordered a cup of orzo soup that was goopy and tepid, and Tess got three hot dogs loaded up with the usuals. Ketchup, mustard, relish, and some strange stuff too. Liquid cheese, potato sticks, bits of bacon, small and pink and burnt like eraser dust. He watched her take turns taking bites of each until Tess said, "Take a photo. You can call it Dying Tess with hot dogs." He laughed a hollow laugh, but Tess paused chewing to pose. When he took the picture, the camera whirled and whirled, and he thought, damn, automatic rewind. That was the last photo of the last roll of film, he said. He felt choked up about this, strangely. The manufacturer had stopped making film for the camera years ago, so it was the last of the camera, too. It was always going to happen. He held it in his hands and banged it against the table edge once, and not hard. In his mind, he took a quick inventory of every photo he'd taken on their trip. A part of him would spend the rest of their visit to the canyon finding the moments he most resented, having no way to frame and to freeze. "Why don't you try living your life?" Tess had said to him, teasing. When this last stretch of her illness began and they knew it was only a matter of time, all Luke had been able to do was take photos. She was right. It wasn't like the camera or anything else could change the future that was rapidly approaching. But her question stung, and he came up with a mean response that he almost spat back. He bit his tongue and turned away from her. Tess said it for him anyway, making it into one of her jokes. She said, "Try living? I know what you must be thinking. Speak for yourself." When Tess learned she was dying, she chose to die. This had become a refrain Luke repeated to keep from pointing his anger at her directly. It made it clear that it was not much of a choice at all, not an if, just a when. The surgery did not cure her, and the radiation did not cure her, and the tumors kept growing. Her long hair fell out, and even her fingers looked skinny. There was one experimental treatment she might have had. She was a perfect candidate, but she turned it down because, in the best case, it might extend her life another small fraction. If it were him, Luke knew, he would have kept fighting for another second until no more seconds were left. He did not think this would be brave. It was just what he would do. He'd probably knock on the doors of all three biotech facilities, desperate, begging for anything they could offer him, no matter the cost. But it was not him, it was Tess. And so here they were completing the list by seeing the canyon. "I only have so much time," she'd said to him. "I don't want to waste it by pretending that isn't true." Tess promised that she wouldn't take the medication that would kill her immediately after they saw the canyon, even though the canyon was the last item on the list. She said she would wait a little bit longer. She had assured him of that. She hadn't even brought the pills on the trip with them. But she still could not decide when exactly she would die, and this was frustrating, not knowing, even now, just how close they were to the end, or how far away. No one knew, Tess would point out if Luke complained to her. That was true. Still, he resented that she knew some things, but not everything. In the last photo of his last roll of film, there would be mustard stained on Tess's chin forever, and Luke would be stunned by it. How she still looked beautiful to him while dying in a diner. He would never be able to bear saying a single word about that out loud. Tess took a final bite of a hot dog, and she burped, loud. She wiped her face with a napkin, erasing the mustard blot. Her eyes focused on the blank space above him. "It's such a joy," she said, as though accepting an award, "to get to eat hot dogs without worrying about all the junk inside of them." Her laughter shook her thin body, and a crumb of bacon fell from her lip onto her plate. "Why don't you try living your life?" It had been a rhetorical question, but he could have answered it. "Because I'm too busy trying not to break down crying all the time?" because it is actually our life, Tess, that you're ending. Because when I look at you, sitting across from me, eating hot dogs, laughing at your own special brand of gallows humor, I see a sepia tone bleed into your face, bathing you already in a pool of nostalgia and time. It was only a few miles to the canyon, and Tess drove. In the passenger seat, Luke took out the list. Soon he would cross out the very last item, and this list would be done. "What do you think?" she said, looking over at him. "Time for another?" It was the kind of joke he hated, because if he were being honest, yes, start a new list. It didn't have to be over, not yet. "Yes, please," he said, and he watched her droop a little. For as long as he had known Tess, she had kept lists for everything. She had a list of movies with snakes in them, and a list of movies in which a man said to a woman, "Don't worry, I've got this." She had a list of restaurants with incomprehensible descriptions of food on the menu, and a list of restaurants where menu items were numbered, so you could just say to a waiter, "I'll take the number 8. This was another way in which they were opposites. When packing for a trip, Luke preferred to spread all possible items out in an array so that he could see them together, hold every item up against every other, and in that way decide which things he needed most to bring. This pair of warm socks or this extra sweater, this thick book he was almost done reading or this thin paperback he had yet to start and might hate. Tess, on the other hand, had a list to work from. She hunted through the apartment, holding the page in her hand, tracking down items in the order they first came to her mind and were documented. Bug spray in the downstairs bathroom, cargo shorts in the bedroom, travel pillow in a hall closet. Each of them made the other crazy this way. Tess cringed at the mess he made just to pack for a weekend. Luke felt anxious from her hurried pacing, upstairs and downstairs, back and forth. When she made her decision and stopped trying new treatments, Tess wrote a list of things that made her feel good. This led to the list of things that might make her feel good, and that was the list that became the list. Capital L, the list of things she still wanted to do with Luke. As they waited in a line of cars to pay their admission, Luke pictured the very near future. He would have the list, and he'd have dozens of canisters of film to develop, and he'd have souvenirs and brochures and ticket stubs that they'd collected along the way. He could spread this all out to form a last array on their bedroom floor. He might hold every item in the pile up and remember it. He would wish he could bring them all with him wherever he went from then on. It would be, he felt, a very long trip he would have to go on without her. So here it was at last, the canyon. "Here it is," they said at the same time. It was both like and unlike what he had expected it to be. A piece of him had maybe thought of it all along as a place they would ascend to. After all, they had kind of been building up to it, making their way through the list. Luke had imagined, dumbly, that there would be a way to see the whole thing as if from very high up. But you can never see the whole of anything that you're still inside of. At the east viewpoint, they met a blind man. He had a guide dog, and he let them pet her. The man told them that he came to the canyon to breathe in the air. They breathed it, the three of them and the dog. It was a great place to take a photograph, but Luke could not take a photograph because he had no more film. So instead, he just blinked slowly and pretended his eyes were a camera shutter clicking closed. They stayed like that, breathing. Luke decided that the air was not any different, but the breathing might be. That if you let it, the breathing could be different each time. "What do you see?" the man asked after a while. Luke said, "I can see signs of time having passed that usually I can't see." "How so?" the man asked. "Like how a river can cut through rock if you give it long enough. I think I knew that, but I couldn't imagine it until now." Luke had overheard a guide tell a tour group that two tiny sediments and one stripe of color could have been laid down when different life forms were roaming the planet. That got him worked up, thinking of time in such massive quantities within something so small. "And what do you see?" the man said to Tess. She was turned with her back to the canyon. "You know," she said, "I always thought it would be a great wonder of emptiness." She stared at Luke. "But now that I'm here, it really doesn't look empty at all."
Rebecca, thank you so much. That was so poignant, and really loved all of those little details of everyday life, going through a list, eating a hot dog in the face of an actually very momentous, heavy moment. That was very beautifully juxtaposed. So Tess and Luke, they are actually one narrative of many. And you had alluded a little bit about how the story is about different connections and weaving of different stories with a very unique interconnected structure. And even just flipping through the book itself, you can kind of get a visual sort of taste of that. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you thought through that and how one might play against the other or propel the narrative forward.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. The structure of this book was probably the hardest thing for me to wrangle. Until writing this novel, I had only ever attempted to write short stories. And I, in fact, thought that's what I was still doing when I started writing this book. So I started it with one short story, which is now midway through the book, about two characters in this sort of futuristic world, which is the world of the book. And I just liked that world, and I kind of wanted to live in it a little bit longer. All of the kind of futuristic elements were about new technology that was kind of meant to end processes that are very painful, like aging and pain. And I just kind of started unpacking that world a little bit more and finding the other characters that were in that original story and telling their stories. And in some ways, the structure sort of like organically emerged as things, as I realized, like, oh, this person is related to this person in this way. And in other ways, it was like through years of revision that I had to kind of really work at those connection points and figure out how do these people interact and at what point in time. The book also spans a lot of time. Like there's the lifespans of individual characters, but then it also tells the ancient history of the place where they're from. So getting the ancient history thread woven through was like in some ways kind of a central thing that everything else hung around. But it was a challenge, and one of the things that kept me kind of interested in the work was figuring out how to structure it, not just as short stories, but into a whole that would be greater than the sum of its parts, I think.
Awesome. I think what's so cool is that we get to hear everyone's writing process, which is like behind the scenes in your mind type of thing, so I appreciate that. You mentioned some of the themes around aging and then, you know, this whole idea of eternal life with the girl who's in a coma and the kind of, you know, fantasy around all of that. And you also, therefore, explore memory and time and our obsession with staying youthful, which is so much, right? It's almost like, how is that not, you know, 1,000 pages long? So maybe you can talk about how you sort of worked through some of those themes, but if there was anything that was unlocked that was surprising, would love to hear that.
Yeah. So writing this book took me the better part of 8 years, and I think there was a lot of discovery in that time. The initial draft of it took the first 4 or 5 years, and then it was revising those threads structurally the way I was talking about, but also thematically. And I think thematically, I used to think of that there were like 3 prongs of the book, which were pain, age, and memory. And then over the years, I found that I was kind of braiding those 3 things together. And I think one of my biggest discoveries was like, they're really related. Like you can't stop aging without also stopping memory. And that's kind of this trade-off that a lot of the characters in the book are dealing with. Luke, as a photographer, is like battling how much do I live my life and how much do I try to preserve my life, especially as he knows, in some ways, his own life, as he knows it, is also ending as his wife is dying. And that's like a push and pull I think a lot of the characters are dealing with, like the desire to preserve the past and a desire to live the present. It's one that I feel like I relate to very deeply myself. But I just was sort of looking at that question from a lot of different angles in the writing process and in the years of writing this book and with all the different characters. I think Tess is a character who comes to a different conclusion about all of it, which is why I like to read her story, because I admire kind of her perspective on it, although I can't claim that it is my own. But just like she seems like one of the few characters in this book who is fully able to live in the present moment, kind of divorced of those attachments and desires.
Very, yeah. Very profound.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, and please welcome Christy Cashman, who will read from Truth About Horses.
Thank you. I'm going to read the prologue, so that sort of sets the stage for the whole book, really. It's basically the story of a father and a daughter navigating grief with the backdrop of horses on a horse farm in South Dakota. So since the prologue really sets the stage for everything, I'll just dive right in if that's okay. "It'd be a miracle if he raced again," the vet told Mom. Then he added a little more quietly, "Be kindest to put him down." For days after the race, Mom walked around the barn like a robot, doing only what had to be done. I knew one day soon she'd wake up and be herself again. I knew it wouldn't be long before she'd stop seeing treasures fall every time she closed her eyes. Mom always got back up. Sometimes it just took her longer than other times. "Come here, boy." I reached my arm over Treasure's stall door. He'd always been the most curious horse in the barn. He'd reach his nose out for a pat or stick his top lip up for attention. He loved to play. When I'd hang his halter and lead shank on the hook outside of his stall, he'd grab them with his teeth and toss them into the aisle just so I'd have to pick them back up again. I'd always laugh at him, put them back, twist his forelock, and call him a devil. 20 minutes later, he'd have tossed his stuff back into the aisle again. But after the race, he kept his nose in the corner, even when there was a full rack of freshly cut hay. His halter and lead shank stayed neatly on the hook. I tried to tempt him with an apple slice. "Look what I got for you, buddy." I held the apple out as far as I could. He didn't move. He lowered his head even farther, his nose in the shavings. I felt Mom's hand brush through my hair and rest on my shoulder. "He's on some pretty strong meds for the pain, hun," she said. "He'll be more alert tomorrow." She opened the stall door and walked over to Treasure, letting her hand drift along his side up to his neck. When she got to his head, she hugged it into her chest and rested her cheek on his forehead. "You did good, my beautiful boy." She held his head with both hands and kissed him on his faint star. "So good." My throat tightened and my eyes stung. "You'll race again," she whispered in his ear. "You'll see." "Come on, you two," Dad called from outside the barn. He was holding the pickup truck door open for Mom. "Let's leave the barn and its worries behind for a while." He said it like it was that easy. Mom slowly slid Treasure's stall door closed, and I followed her out to the truck. "Mom?" I tugged on her sleeve. She turned to look at me. I couldn't even say it. "Don't worry, Pumpkin. We're not putting him down." Dad gave Mom a smooch on the cheek before closing her door. Then he walked over to the driver's side singing, "Jesse, I'll always cut fresh flowers for you. And Jesse, I'll always make the wine cold for you and put on cologne and sit by the phone." Sometimes we drove so we could reset after a horse had a bad race or came up lame or we'd have a pain in the ass client. "It's best to put things behind you and move on," Dad would say. He didn't like to dwell on things, like the race we were all trying to unsee. As if a drive could stop those last few seconds from looping around and around in our brains. As if we could forget how close we'd been to winning the Black Elk, the race that every person around here dreams about. How we were all just about to leap a giant chasm together, the one that separates the people who talk about doing things from the people who do things. How around the kitchen table, maybe next season became this season. Suddenly, we were talking about race day. Every conversation filled with words like the pace, the cutaway, and the going. The day of that drive, the air was so clear it almost hurt my eyes. Everything had a sharpness that most of the time wasn't there. We pulled out of the driveway in the pickup, them in the front, me in the back. I looked back at the barn and saw things I'd never noticed. Chipping paint, the sagging roof, uneven doors, unstained boards patching up holes. For so long, just seeing the barn made me feel like everything would be all right. Now all I saw was a tired old building that looked like it was trying to lie down and let the grass fold into it. I rolled my tongue around to find the sweet, buttery taste from the caramel apple I'd had the day of the race, But there was no taste. My mouth was dry as a moth's wing. We never had a plan. We'd just drive. Dad pretended, like he always did, that there was some magical force making his hands turn the steering wheel this way or that. At an intersection, he asked me to guess which way the magic force would take us next. Left, I said. Let's see if you're right, he said. I mean left. Then he pretended like he was fighting with the steering wheel to make the magic go my way. But it was too old and stupid a joke to make me laugh. We headed out of Birdwood and took the road that followed along the Ghost Hawk River, which widens and narrows before it forks. In some places it gushes with white rapids, but in other places it creeps so slowly you'd swear it wasn't moving at all. We drove past where the river feeds into the black mirror of Horse Thief Lake. At Ghost Hawk Park, Mom waved goodbye to the river. There it goes, she said, like it was a person walking out the door. I watched the rolling water rush off into a forest of giant pine and craggy rock. Dad kept steering the truck further and farther from the barn, through the grasslands and croplands and toward the badlands. We passed picnickers and campers. Then he started singing the South Dakota state song. Mom rolled her eyes and shook her head at his awful singing voice. That only made him sing louder. Come on, everybody, he said. Hail South Dakota, the state we love the best, land of our fathers, builders of the West, home of the Badlands and the Rushmore's ageless shrine. Dad kept singing on his own while he pulled around his big rigs and livestock carriers and bullet-shaped campers. When he finally took a breath, Mom looked at him and said, Joe, I never knew you couldn't sing. The three of us laughed, mostly because Mom finally made a joke. We drove through lush, dense forest. When we passed the cliffs that are home to the pronghorn, two of them leaped across the road in front of us. But then the road wound through wide open plains. I could see Smuggler's Rock in the distance. We kept driving until there was nothing else to see but pink rock and a gray road ahead, straight as a pool stick. The kind of boring scenery that always puts me to sleep. I woke from my nap to see Dad looking at me in the rearview mirror. Did you enjoy your nap as much as I enjoyed mine? Dad is the king of stupid jokes. I didn't laugh. I looked out the window instead. The same pink hue tinted the air. Rose quartz, Mom reminded me. But how does the pink in the rock make the air pink? It's all about reflection, she said. I looked at her reflection. Mom's face was perfectly framed in the side mirror. Her dark brown eyes focused on something as we passed, let it go, then followed something else. She kept tucking her hair behind her ears, but the wind lifted strands and pulled one whole twist of it right out the half-opened window. It lay flat against the glass of my window, a giant black wing. I think they're close, Mom said. I can feel it in my bones. I always sat up when Mom felt something in her bones. It had always been something I wouldn't want to miss. And when we rounded the bend, there they were, wild horses, like Mom's thoughts made them appear. Dad pulled over to the side of the road. We got out of the truck and walked to the flat plain's edge. I stood between my parents. They were each holding one of my hands like they did when I was little. The horses were about a football field length away. Most of them ignored us. They grazed and ambled from one patch of dusty grass to another. Some raised their heads to look at us, then lowered them to graze again. Seeing horses in the wild is like glimpsing another world you knew about but forgot existed. Seeing them gallop across thousands of acres of open land is nothing like seeing horses in a fenced-in field, peaceful and content, like decorations in a pasture. Here, the land looked like it was made for them, like the wind had flattened the plains just for their hooves to gallop along, like the mountains saw their glistening coats and powerful legs and moved aside to make room enough for all of them to gather. One black horse, much taller than the rest, threaded his way through the herd. He nipped some of the mares on the haunches, telling them it was time to move on. A dust cloud followed his gallop. His stride was monstrous. Then he galloped toward us. Oh, shit, Dad said. He reached his arm across me and grabbed hold of one of Mom's wrists. Whoa, buddy, No one wants to hurt you. But the black horse kept moving closer. Don't run, Mom said. Stay still. Then he stopped, right in front of us. He raised his head and looked at me, straight at me. His eyes were dark pools, and his mane fell like a curtain against his sculpted neck. Then he turned, tossed his head, and charged off with the rest of the herd. Dad's hand shook a little when he let go of Mom's wrist. He didn't dare mess with me, Dad joked. Mom started laughing, really laughing. That was crazy, she said. Kind of scary and beautiful, like a dream. Her eyes sparkled again. Mom was back. We watched the horses until they were specks on the horizon. Well, time to make like a bread truck and haul buns, Dad said, trying to get Mom to laugh again. I climbed into the back seat. The race was still with me, but it was less vivid now, less in my face, like all those miles magically gave our minds just enough room to think other thoughts. You were right about the drive, Dad. Yep, he said. Nothing like getting scared to death to make you forget your troubles. But for some reason, the horses hadn't scared me. I could have stood there forever, my hair whipping across my face, my feet feeling the rumble from the herd's hooves, my back feeling the warmth of the sun. Dad reached over and squeezed Mom's hand. He left it there. And Mom put her hand on top of Dad's. Then she turned and smiled at me. I could feel her thoughts. She was getting ready again to dream. Then Dad swerved the truck to the right. Huge chicken crates were falling from the truck in front of us. They crashed open on the road in an explosion of white feathers and sawdust, like some whacked out pinata. One crate tumbled by my window, breaking open as it landed. Chickens scattered into the road. Another crate fell in front of us, breaking into pieces with every roll. My body leaned as far as the seatbelt let me. My shoulder kept slamming against the door. Something hit our windshield, and Dad steered hard to the left, our tires bashing into rocks and banging into holes. I saw everything inside the car. Mom's hand reaching up and clutching Dad's arm. Dad's arm straight as a board, trying to hold the steering wheel steady. A spilled coffee cup rolling around on the floorboard. The barn keys swinging from the rearview mirror. My parents' heads tilting and nodding like bobblehead dolls. Everything was in slow motion. But outside, things rushed by so fast I couldn't tell rock from sky. I knew we were off the road when I saw nothing but pink dust. I knew we'd been tumbling in circles because I felt like throwing up. I knew we were upside down because I was hanging from my seatbelt. I knew I was alive when I looked at my dad. I wanted him to crack a stupid joke, but I knew from the look on his face that Mom was dead.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That prologue is almost like a short story in itself. It was very powerful and very beautiful as well. I'd love to talk about the relationship with horses and also the sort of figure of mystique that they have. Even just driving by a horse farm, you automatically turn your head. And that beautiful scene that you had just told us all about, I think is very reflective of that. And I know that you are a lover of horses as well. Mm. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that sort of mystique and magic and how you sort of played with that in the novel and if that had a personal tie.
Well, yes, absolutely. I did grow up with horses. We've had them since I was little, and I still have a lot of them now, more than I should, but no. horses were a huge part of my growing up. My parents let me raise a foal from a baby when I was 9 years old, so that was something that was absolutely life-changing for me. My book is not an autobiography, but you might think it is because I also lost my mother when I was 17. So, but my horses were, it was during that time, I think, that my relationship with my horse and the fact that I could really kind of immerse myself in the world of the barn and horses and go on rides was really what was comforting to me. You know, it's almost maybe the only thing that I felt comfort in. And so in my book, as much as I could, I wrote about the loss and the longing that I experienced, but through someone else's through someone else's eyes. My parents were not horse people in this book. Her parents, Reese's parents, the protagonist, they're big horse people. They live in South Dakota. They have a horse ranch in operation. And I think probably I always wanted that when I was little. I always wished my parents were horse people, so I made her parents horse people. A lot of that, you know, what if or stuff that I think when you're at least writing your first novel, and second, I guess, I mean, I can feel that now when I'm working on my second, is, you know, you have a glimpse of something in your life, and you just think, well, what if this happened? What if you just took it a little bit further? Or what if my life had gone this way? And a lot of my writing comes out of that question, what if? And with horses, I think the reason that I felt like there's sort of a mystical herd in it that you were referencing, and I just feel like no matter what, horses are interesting because they're unpredictable. You know, even the most domesticated horses are unpredictable. There is a mysterious quality about them. They're kind of dangerous. I mean, just getting on a horse, there's a little bit of risk involved, of course, when your feet are off the ground and you're on an animal that has a mind of its own. It's a little bit dangerous. So I think that, you know, for me, life is dangerous. Just waking up every day is dangerous. And so I guess I recognize that. And it's risky to, you know, walk out your door. It's risky to put yourself out there and write a book. And it's risky to attempt to do anything. And I guess that there's something about horses that reminds me of that and reminds me that it is important in life to take risks. And, you know, for me as a kid with horses, that's a little bit maybe what that was about. I enjoyed that there was a dangerous aspect to it, and it was risky.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. So Reese, your main character.
Yeah.
There's so many emotional ups and downs. And I feel like the tapestry of kind of like her emotional life is very much part of this novel as well. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you thought to develop that, because it's not like you want to, you know, just focus on her sadness and her tragedy of the accident with her mother. But there are also moments when we laugh with her as well. So I'd love to hear your thoughts around that.
I thought it was more interesting to make her angry than sad. I think that's a much more interesting emotion. And so I made her sad. I made her angry because she was in pain. And she and her dad, as you read the book, you realize that they go in totally different directions. They kind of abandon each other emotionally after the mother is killed. And the rest of the story is about them navigating their pain and their anger and the way they each handled that in not the healthiest ways. I made her angry and swear a lot because I just thought it was funny and interesting, and more interesting than somebody who's, you know, sobbing in their pillow every night, I guess.
Awesome. Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for being with us. Please give a round of applause. These are amazing storytellers. Congratulations on your debut novels. They will be signing books right outside this main entrance of the cafe, so please say hello and stop by. And again, if you feel like donating, please do. Thank you so much.